Shall we just continue?
Yeah. Yes, we shall. Welcome back to our second segment of Way of the Yogi, and I will turn it directly over to James.
Thank you, Zana. So we just finished our first segment this afternoon on the 13th sutra, Tatrasthitau yatno abhyasa. So Patanjali is describing what is practice, what is abhyasa. So it's the effort to secure steadiness. And we said, what does effort mean in the context of yoga? Yatna, it comes from a root, yam, which means to harness. So it means to harness and deploy our energy and our effort skillfully for our own highest interests. Later in the second chapter, Patanjali will define and explore what it means to practice in a lot more detail. And when he gives the cornerstones of practice at the very beginning of the second chapter, he will describe them as tapasvadya yeshwara pranidhanani kriya yoga. So the actions, the foundation actions and principles of yoga are tapaha, svadhyaya, nishwara pranidhana. And as those of us who like discussed over the weekend, the real discipline of tapas is to ensure that the heat of our practice is a nourishing one, that nourishes like spring sunshine, that allows things to grow gently, steadily. It doesn't scorch us dry, doesn't burn us out. Svadhyaya, to ensure that it's beneficial for ourselves. And Ishwara Pranidhana, that's really in our own highest interest, that it's directed towards the Supreme, our essence. So, abhyasa, it does require engagement, does require effort, but that effort is a discerning one, which is for our own highest interest. And that's not the end of the definition of abhyasa. And what is more, Satu dirga kala nayantarya satkara sevito dhridabhumihi. And what is more, for that effort to become dhridabhumihi, well established, firmly rooted, it must also be dirga kala. I think you're not familiar with the kala, the word kala. What is kala? Time. Dirga.
Oh, for a long time.
Yeah, dirga means long. So, for a long time. Nairantarya. Not interrupted, uninterrupted. Satkara sevito. So, this morning, Andy, we were talking about seva and karma yoga. Yeah? So, sevita, attended to.
Served.
Yeah, satkara, with wholeheartedness, with devotion, with fullness of attention, with assiduity. So, and that practice, that effort, the effort to secure practice, the practice becomes firmly rooted, well established, well grounded, when for a long time it is uninterrupted and attended to with wholehearted attention, with full presence and awareness and devotion. Yes, another way we could describe it. So what does that mean in practical terms? When do we practice?
All the time.
All the time. And so that reminds us that what is yoga practice about? It's about all of life. And when we take recourse to yoga technique, some of us are very fond of taking time inside with everything shut down, and we may spend a shorter or a longer time in meditation. Some of us are very fond of yoga asana. We may devote a certain amount of time to that most days of the week. But what is that time for?
It's for self-study, for going within and exploring ourselves and our limitations, our potentials, everything.
In order to then be able to go out and maintain the fullness of that awareness.
Right. And maintain the steadiness.
That metaphor that you used the other day about the arrow.
The arrow. I know some of you are coming to the talk this evening and you're going to hear it again. But it bears repeating because it's, as Paul said, it's such a great image. And this image is of an archer. So the archer pulls back his bow. Now imagine you've never seen a bow and arrow before. The person comes, he's never seen a bow and arrow. And he sees this person aiming at the tree. And he's pulling, oh look at him, he's pulling it away from the place he wants it to go. What a fool. But of course the archer knows that if he wants to fire his arrow, can you see that tree over there? Diane, move out of the way. So he wants to fire his arrow towards the tree. He's not going to push his arrow towards the tree. He's going to draw the bow back. And then he can let his arrow be unleashed with real potential, with real
energy
and real purpose in its on its trajectory. So sometimes people see the yogi who's devoting some time to internal practice, that cultivation of awareness, and the person might say, let's say for example the yogi takes a couple of hours out of the day to dive inside or to study or to practice, in whatever way they do. A worldly person might say, you spend 2 hours a day sitting still, doing nothing. Are you crazy? Think what you could do with 14 hours a week. That's like a whole, two whole working days. Think how much you could da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yes? But what does the yogi know? The yogi knows that when they draw the attention internally, when they direct with discernment the effort in the direction of integration, using whatever technique resonates with them. For some people it could be that they devote some time to simple housework, but they use that as a meditation and they're very mindful in their actions. For other people it could be, you know, doing yogasana. Classically, it's to dive inside twice a day at the around the time, well, in India around the time of the sunrise and the sunset, but in at these extreme latitudes, that image doesn't hold so good, but twice a day to dive inside. And then when we dive inside, what happens? We get that impression of samadhi. We experience samadhi as best we can. So we take recourse to meditative technique and we get some value of samadhi. And it doesn't matter if we don't get the full-on experience. Sometimes people say, oh, samadhi. Who experiences samadhi? Patanjali tells us there are many layers of samadhi. Yogic technique is we just experience it as best as we can. And what do we then experience in the world? We experience greater steadiness. We know for ourselves that our yoga practice is working. And so we know we're like the archer. The person who's never seen the bow and arrow before thinks that we're pulling it in the wrong direction. We're going away from where we want to go. But the practicing meditator knows, no, when I draw inside, it's like I'm drawing the bowstring back to be able to then act in the world with that much greater precision. Clarity, precision, and efficiency. So when the bow is drawn back, what state is the bowstring in?
Taut.
Yeah, it's still, but it's filled with dynamism, potential energy. So similarly, we draw in order to be able to act in the outside world with greater efficiency, with greater skillfulness. And there's the idea that the two aspects of practice, the internal practice and the taking it into the world, they support each other. So we dive inside and we feel that peacefulness. Then we go out and act with that impression lively inside us. How else does it feel when we experience that state of integration?
Full.
When we feel full, we don't need to go rushing out in search of satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And so then, when we go out and act in the world, we feel full. So it doesn't matter what the world gives us. It gives us things we want. We can enjoy them with discrimination, discernment. It gives us something we don't want. It doesn't shake us so much. We feel full and grounded. And so then, having inserted, as it were, that lively fullness of awareness, we then go out and navigate the challenges, opportunities of the day, and then we dive in again, and we reaffirm that experience, and then we go out and act again. And there's the idea that as we act with that experienced life, we get more and more skillful in our external activity. And that then facilitates us diving more deeply. And that then facilitates even more skillful activity. So the two support each other. And as it becomes even more firmly established, there's the idea that we can take that fullness of equilibrium and integration into all our actions. And the very advanced yogi, they don't need to be in solitude or with the external shut down to feel that internal fullness. It pervades all their external activity. And hence, there's always this emphasis within the tradition is that internal practice is wonderful, is one thing, but it's always in relation to our external activity. But practice, long time, uninterrupted, attended to with assiduous devotion, with a whole heart. And that relates back to what we spoke about in relation to the previous sutra. It's a discerning effort, it's a skillful effort, it's not an extreme exertion. It's something that is nourishing.
I was doing my personal yoga practice for several months, and it got to the point where I was going for 2 and 3 hours sometimes. Mm. And then I realized that wasn't maintainable. It was it wasn't feasible to do that in everyday life. And then it got to a point where if I wasn't able to do it, I started beating myself up because I couldn't do it. So it's very important to have that discernment in what is realistic in practice. Yeah.
And absolutely. Of course, that's also something that it's not always the same. Mm-hmm. The seasons of practice. Sometimes our life situation might allow us to go on retreat and meditate for 2 weeks and do nothing else. Other times we might feel, the relative needs my help at the moment.
Oh, 10 minutes a day.
At work, I really need to give a little bit. This project, we really need to get it finished. I'm part of the team. I feel, so we have to adapt. So one of the things that we can do is that when we feel the opportunity and the urge to practice in a nourishing way, let us embrace it. And then those times when it's not so easy, let us decide what is the kind of minimum that's practical for us. And let's do our best to maintain that and ensure that it's one that's kind of, compatible with our worldly responsibilities. And that, again, it's something that we can constantly refine.
And I like what you said about it's every minute of every day. It's a practice.
Yeah. Definitely.
So even if you don't get that time that you're sequestered, to isolate and practice, be mindful of
definitely
practicing.
And one thing that I think it is worth stating is that, like some of us were having this conversation, is like one of my dear friends recently had a period of time to spend with family, and her regular practice took a back seat. But I said, family yoga, that's real intense practice, That's real practice, If you're aware of it, of course, we like to do our meditation and our asana and everything, like normal. But if we're there in the cauldron of family life, and we're just doing our best to bring steadiness and love to that environment, this is very powerful practice. I had a friend of mine when I used to live in Thailand. It just so happened that at a certain stage in her life, like everything seemed to be crashing down. Within the family, the husband left. One son on the verge of suicide, another son very sick. Just like everything comes crashing in. And she came to me one time and said, I feel like I can't meditate. And so I related what my teacher had once said to me, that it's like, in those times when we feel that everything's whirling in chaos, if we make that effort to just keep practicing then, it might not feel like we're getting anywhere because that whirling's so intense. But if during those times we just do our best to keep cultivating the center as best we can, actually that practice is very, very powerful. It might not feel like we're getting so deep. When everything's smooth and easy, we can feel, and we get a more refined experience. But when everything's whirling in chaos, and we just keep doing our best to cultivate, it's actually very, very powerful. Because it's like momentum's flooding in one direction, but we've got enough presence to actually be able to kind of harness some of that and tune into the center. That's very, very powerful. And Dirghakara Nairantari Satkara Sevito Dhrira Bhumihi. For it to become well established, where does it become well established? In this body, in the world. How is the world? It's nature, it's always changing. And so our practice has to be responsive. And nature is teaching us how to do that. So yesterday evening, a couple of you only week to another. Yeah, a couple of us. Yeah, a couple of us. I'm sure it was both sides of the room. There was someone, yeah. So three of us yesterday were at a talk in a place where we could see a mighty tree out the window. So nature is teaching us always, how does a mighty tree become mighty? How much of a tree do we see above the ground?
Just a part of it.
About half, yeah. So the majesty of its height and its, you know, expanse is only as much as the depth and extensiveness of its root system. For practice to become well-rooted, it must be steady, attended to with a whole heart for a long time. How does a tree grow? It grows in accord with its nature. A tree doesn't pretend to be anything it's not. You don't find an oak, I want to be a cherry tree. You don't find the ash, I want to be a weeping willow, I'm sick of being an oak. No, they just be the oak, be the ash. And what? How do they grow? In term with the seasons, yeah? Winter comes, time for me to rest. Spring comes. New growth, the abundance of the summer. And over the years, these mighty trees grow taller and stronger, more majestic and more inspiring. How? Because they don't force things. They work in tune with nature, in harmony with the seasons. And at the same time, they establish their roots. So when the storms come, they have the stability and the grace to be able to weather them. How does the sapling survive those first strong gusts of wind? Only because the roots allow it to balance. So similarly, as we are practicing, we establish our roots as best we can with that internal practice, with that mindful activity. And then when the storms come, they actually help the tree grow stronger, yeah? When the rains pour down, it can then work with that storm for its own positive growth. And so, practice, we practice in the world. We practice in this body, which is made of the stuff of nature. So if we want to become well-rooted, we have to work with the reality of that. So if we want to establish roots, we have to be like the tree, true to our own nature. So we work with the reality of our own individual personality, our own strengths, weaknesses. We don't deny our weaknesses and leave them out of the equation in our practice. We invite every part of ourselves, body, mind, senses, different layers of the mental spheres, the emotional sphere. We let it all be fully participative in our practice. And then our practice can really become well-rooted. Does that make sense? So shall we come to Vairagya? So this word, Vairagya, which is a difficult word to translate, but this is the beauty of Patanjali. He's going to define it for us. So, drishtanu shravika vishaya vitrishnasya vashikara sangya vairagyam. So what is vairagyam? Vashikara sangya. It is that awareness or that exalted state or that clearer state of awareness in which drishta, anushravika, and in which there is vitrishnasya, in which there is vitrishnasya means of the one who has no thirst. For what? Drishta, that which is seen. Anushravika, that which has been heard about in the scriptures, for example. What is vishaya? It means objects of enjoyment. So vairagya is that state in which there is
a desirelessness,
but it's because there is a subtler, more refined awareness, which means there is a lack of thirst for objects that we may have seen or heard about. So seen or heard about. So it's not that, I'm detached. This is just a natural state of awareness. So let us say, for example, that you're invited out to lunch at the house of somebody you don't know so well, but you met this person and you had a nice feeling and you willingly and gratefully accept the invitation. You go to the house and then they're still preparing lunch, then you realize that you have stepped into the house of a master chef. And you can, you smell these wonderful aromas, and you get to peep out into the garden. You see all these beautifully fresh herbs. You see all these beautifully fresh vegetables. And then their host finishes in the kitchen and invites you into the dining room. You see this array of beautifully, subtly prepared dishes. And they're all so health-giving. And the portions are all so appropriate. And you're fed this wonderful meal. And at the end of the meal, you feel completely satiated but wonderfully light. So you can run up the stairs to get a bigger a view of the extents of their fruit orchards in the back garden afterwards, for example. And then, later in the day, your friend comes to pick you up and drives by Wendy's. And on outside Wendy's it says, try our, what does it say? Try our, what did it say?
I don't even know what it was. It's from that.
Yes, try our 14-ounce chicken McNuggets today. Are you likely to fall victim to that advertiser? I should be careful what I say, yeah? As you, let's erase that reference to a particular place. But as you, let's say your friend invites you for some fast food. Come on, it's great. Finger-licking good. Are you likely to want to have that?
No.
No. But if you've been starving, and then your friend offers you something that's not so good, oh, thank you, I'm starving. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So the idea is like, vairagya is the natural effect of abhyasa. When we experience integration, then we're not so interested in the externals. So it's not, so one of my friends in Thailand who was had grown up in Thailand, it's a Buddhist country, and some people, they kind of get a lot of Buddhist education when they're growing up. And this sutra, she's like, practice non-attachment. It's a contradiction. Right. It's rubbish, this yoga stuff. how can you, it says you've got to practice all the time, so you've not got to care. No, that's not what vairagya means. It's not that we don't care about practice. He's just told us. Practice, you do it with a whole heart and devotion. The vairagya, the non-attachment, is the natural effect of practice. So practice gives us that experience, it allows us, it reveals that internal fullness. And then from that internal fullness emerges a natural desirelessness. The world gives me those things I like and cherish, I enjoy them. The world gives me things that it doesn't give me those things, no problem, I'm full. Does that make sense? So vairagya is the natural consequence of abhyasa. It's not something that we have to actively cultivate, it's the effect of practice. It's like, for example, to give an example in yogasana. Sometimes, for example, people say, lift the knee. Have you ever experienced an instruction like this?
Yes.
But lifting the knee, so if it's not what we want to do. If we lift the knee, then we create tension on the front side of the knee joint. We start to close the front of the knee. In a yoga posture, if it's really going to be Sthira Sukhamasana, we want to be open on all sides. So lifting the knee is not what we want to do. What we want to do is open, broaden with the inhale, lengthen with the exhale. Then the knee naturally gets lifted, but only in such a way that the front and back of the knee are evenly open. And so lifting the knee is an effect. It's not an action. Yeah? It's the consequence of a much more global action. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So similarly with vairagya, the desirelessness comes from experiencing that state of being full. When we do yogasana and we exert even effort through the whole system, we broaden with each inhale, we lengthen with each exhale, we invite even space into the whole system. And how does that feel physically?
Expansive.
It feels great, so we don't need to lust after a particular visual representation of.
That is.
Maybe my bike. Somebody's bike.
So we don't.
Nobody out there, right?
Huh?
Nobody out there?
No injuries.
So it's not that we're lusting after a particular execution of a posture, rather we feel, oh yes, I feel the fullness, I feel the balance, I feel the richness of working in this even way. So maybe the kneecap has lifted a little bit, but it's just a natural consequence of that even action. It's not like a direct lifting which constrains part of the body. Does that make sense? So desirelessness is like, oh, I don't feel like practicing today. Or, oh, I feel like practicing today, so I shouldn't, because that's my desire. No. And one thing about yoga, this is clarified in many of the texts, is that yoga is yoga. What does yoga mean? It's that state of balance. It's not vyoga, and it's not sanyoga. Sanyoga means like very... Yoga can mean coming together or attached, yeah? Like union, attach. Sanyoga or sanyukta means well joined. Viyukta means separated. Viyoga, separation. Sanyoga, conjunction. And yoga. So when we do yoga, it has to be yoga, not sanyoga and not viyoga. So it's not like we cling to the practice, but it's not like, oh, I'm a yogi, I just go with the flow. No. Remember, we've used that image. We have to get in the flow. And that requires an exertion of effort. He's already told us. Notice the order. Abhyasa first, then vairagya. So desirelessness is not something that we try to actively cultivate on its own. We cultivate it through abhyasa. So it's not that, oh, I'm a yogi, I don't care about anything. No, I'm a yogi. I care about that which is nourishing. I care about harnessing my effort and my energy in the world in a sensible way, in a constructive way, in a positive way, in a nourishing way, in a way that is supportive of harmony. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so it's that. So when we experience that internal fullness, it's like the person who dines at that house of the master chef every day, they know what it's like to eat beautifully prepared, fresh food. And what? How does it feel when we have that type of diet for a long time? We feel very healthy. We don't want another type of diet. But the person who doesn't know that, they might think, oh, I want this, it tastes good, yeah? When we learn through experience what it's like to be nourished by our diet, naturally we disincline from that which is not for our own highest interest. And this is the same with practice and non-attachment. So we cultivate integration. We make an effort to experience integration and to carry that into all our activities. And then there is a natural disinclination to those things of the external that would pull us away from it, because we know this is richer. I don't want to disturb that internal richness by overindulging in that, for example. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So we experience the integration, and that becomes the platform to support more sustained integration. Does that make sense? Yeah. And then he expands on that in the next one. Tatparam purushakyater gunavai trishnyam. So the vairagya, tatparam, that gets even higher, that gets more to a more extreme level, a more exalted level, or a more elevated level, when purushakyatehi gunavai trishnyam. So vaitrishnyam, it's related to that vitrishnasya in the previous one. So there is this kind of lack of thirsting for this, being kind of impervious to, not so pulled by, guna. What are the gunas?
It's Rajas, Tamas. Yeah,
just basically all of the play of nature. So he mentioned in the previous one, drishta, things that we have seen, or things that we have heard about. And this is important in the yoga context, because some of us have been discussing this. Sometimes we hear about things that can happen when we do yoga, yeah? We might meet a teacher who we overhear him talking to about, yeah, so when I flew to the celestial loka, you know, and so when I manifested three bodies, and was it, and we think, oh, yeah, I quite like that, Siddhi. You know? Yeah. Do you know, sometimes we'd like to be in more than one place at once, yeah? So, drishta, things we've seen. So, for example, yesterday, I had some really nice Rainier cherries, yeah? I've seen Rainier cherries. If Andy was to say to me, oh, Erica's calling, she's at the shop, would you like any cherries? I would say, yes, I've seen them before. I know, they're so good, I want some more. Yeah? Something I have seen. Anushravika, something I've read about, I've heard about. In chapter 3, it's all there. Yes, you can run several human bodies. You can teleport yourself. Wouldn't that be great? But I'm not lusting after that, because I know that the experience of internal integration is far richer. So potentially makes this very clear in the third chapter. He says, you know, when you're there. So one of my friends, when I was teaching a course on the sutras in Mysore, it's a great Austrian guy, Anton, really intelligent guy, really bright. And he's like, all this siddhi stuff, all these vibhuti, you know, it's like, why is it there? I'm happy with my practice as it is, you know. Why does he have to go on about flying and, you know, all this? And I was like, well, imagine, Anton, there you are in your meditation room one day, and then you suddenly realize you're floating in the air. How will you feel? It might shake you. So but this is the manual of meditation. So who came here by car today? I think, yeah. In the car, in the glove compartment, when you buy it, there's usually a manual, yeah? It doesn't just tell you about all the everyday things. It tells you about some things that might go wrong, or some things that you could do if you want to fine-tune it. It's quite comprehensive. Patanjali is very comprehensive. So sometimes these powers can come. But what are they? What are they for? The idea is they're just a natural consequence of the refining of the system, to prepare it for the full rise of Kundalini, for the full integration of the whole system into that experience of unity and oneness. And so along the way, it's just normal that one develops certain capacities. Doesn't mean we have to develop them all, but it just can happen. So how do we deal with them? So potentially makes it clear right here in the very beginning, we don't thirst after those things. And he tells in the third chapter, if you are there sitting in meditation and you suddenly have this new type of experience and you're feeling very, very clear, and then suddenly this host of celestial angels come by in this flying vehicle and say, hey, we've been waiting for you, the party started, come. You say, it's very kind of you, but I'm quite okay here now. You run along and I'll stay here. Because the yogi recognizes that internal integration is far superior to anything that can be experienced externally, even through in these loftier realms.
Basically another level of testing.
Yes, exactly.
Ready to
exactly. So he's saying that when, even beyond that, when anything to do with the realm of change, when that doesn't hold any sway over us, then that's the real full-on expression or the full-on experience of vairagya. And how will we know if we are there? So we could, for example, think, oh yes. Like in Vyasa, he'll talk about, you know, wine and women and song. You know, they give all these things that people could run after in the world. And we might think, yes, the worldly attachments. I'm calm, I'm steady. But then the angels come and they say, yes, but there's a reason you're no longer lusting after those worldly things. Because you have the sensibility to enjoy the celestial delights, and we want to. We're waiting for you to come. You like singing kirtan? Come and sing with the Gandharvas. And you think, wow. Yeah. So, how do we know if we are steady? We can put it to the test, and so these things will happen. But there's the idea of vairagya. It's just a natural consequence of the fullness of that internal experience. What happens when we do? Maybe we've experienced this at a certain level. We feel, oh yes, I do enjoy living in this way. And then some old habit rears its head and we overindulge. And you think, oh no, actually, I didn't want to do that. And once we've repeated that a few times, then we leave that old habit behind, naturally. Yeah, mm-hmm. It just comes smoothly as an effect of the deepening of the richness of the experience of integration. So the fight becomes smoother. It becomes a natural progression. Of course we can work to expedite it even more, but that desirelessness is just a natural consequence of abhyasa. Is that clear?
Yes.
Yeah. And then he talks about what are the different things that we can experience when we practice. Vitarka vichara randa smita rupa nugamat sampragnyataha. So sampragnyataha, that type of samadhi, that type of absorption in which we're still aware. So it's not the deepest type of samadhi, but when we experience, when we start to experience integration, what comes? Vitarka, vichara, ananda, asmita. These things, rupa, they take form. anugamat, as a consequence of sampragyata, of that experience of samadhi, of that awareness. It's not the complete full absorption, but when we're aware, there's still some awareness, there's still some residue. Sampragyata.
So, and JN is
Nya.
Yeah, that's
Nya.
I wrote it down in my book because I've heard it pronounced.
Oh,
wait, so in North India, they often, and sometimes in books, you can see it transliterated as G-Y-A, mm-hmm. Jnana. But if you say that to a South Indian pundit, he will tell you, no, don't.
Jnana.
Jnana. So it's, like, you know the word gnocchi in Italian? Jnana. It's a bit like that, Jnana. So it's sampragyataha. So sampragyataha, it's like that type of integrative awareness or trance or absorption, but we're still kind of aware of ourselves. It's not the full-on absorption. But so when we're starting to get a glimpse of samadhi, when we're starting to experience samadhi, what happens? Vitarka, vichara, ananda, and asmita. So vitarka, it's like stimulating our intellectual curiosity, our reasoning. It's starting to expand our field of awareness. So let's say you experience this, and then you recognize, yes, there's something more, that idea that there is something more to reality. And so it stimulates, what is my essential nature? So some people talk about, who am I? And, I'm not the body. I'm not the mind, I'm watching myself thinking. So I think, therefore I am. The meditator knows, no, it's not because of thinking that I exist, there's something subtler than that. So we start to meditate, so it stimulates this curiosity to probe deeper. To analyze, to explore. And then vichara, we experience that more meditative awareness. And then that also has the consequence of what? Ananda. We feel some quality of blissfulness. And then asmita, the sense of, yes, I am, I exist. So when we shut everything down, I'm not the body, I'm not the mind, I'm not the senses, I'm not the ego. I am. And so it begins to open the gate to that subtler perception of what we really are, that subtler experience of what we really are. And this is, again, it's just the consequence of practice. And then virama pratyabhyasa purva sanskara sheshonyaha. So this is kind of potentially here starting to describe different types of samadhi. So, 18. So, sanskara shesho nyaha. Anyaha means the other. So the other type of what? The other type of samadhi. So previously, sampragyataha, where we still have some subjective awareness. The other type, purvaha, is preceded by virama pratyabhyasa. So virama means the cessation, the stopping of what? Of the notion of what? Of identification with the external. Yes. So he says, gradually, as we keep practicing, then there rises more and more of a sense of identification with that internal realm of fullness. And so we open the gate to integration, and then we get used to traveling that pathway. That experience gets fuller, and then that opens another gate to a state of integration in which our limited subjective awareness falls away, and subject and object begin to become one. It's a subtler form of samadhi. So we get a glimpse of samadhi. It sparks our curiosity. It changes the way we begin to perceive ourselves and everything around us. It also allows us to see things in a slightly subtler way and experience life in a subtler way. It gives rise to a state of deeper happiness and a sense of, yes, what I am, what am I really? And then, once that becomes a little bit livelier, it invites the experience of a deeper, subtler level of samadhi. And what is that level? So that is basically merging into oneness, merging into unity. And then in the 19th sutra, bhava pratyayo videha prakritilayanam. So for the prakritilayas and the videhas, this is just pratyaya, the cause of this, just comes from bhava, from their existence. So basically it's saying they're born that way. So certain classes of beings, they're just born in this state of absorption. So Vyasa says, there are certain types of beings that live in a certain realm. and they just have that. They have a lifetime of being absorbed, you know, some high exalted state, preparing them for the final checking out when they can merge fully. But for the rest of us, something else has that will come in the next sutra. So, and sometimes we hear of people who inhabit this world who are like this. So I think we've probably all heard stories of great saints who, as a small child, they left the home, they went to the forest, they sought out the guru. There they are at infant school. Everybody loves the child. All his classmates are enchanted by this child. But when he's not playing happily with the rest of them, he just goes into these states of deep silence that can last for hours. And sometimes the parents think, something's amiss here. And they take the child to the doctor, and the doctor thinks, your child's perfectly healthy. They take the child to the local medicine man, the local medicine man thinks, your child is very special. And then a great master visits, and they take the child to the great master, and they say, I would love to be afflicted by the condition that your child is in. And we hear these stories of these great masters, and they're just born into this state of absorption and unity, and then they shower their blessings on humanity. But for the rest of us, if we're not absorbed in it from birth, then another sutra of real instruction, the 20th, Shatta virya smriti samari prajna purvaka itaresham. It's one of my favorite sutras in the first chapter. Itaresham, for others, prajna, this state of discriminative awareness, this state of exalted awareness, purvaka is preceded by shadha, virya, smriti, and samadhi. We know samadhi, yeah? That state of integration. Smriti we've already heard as well. What was smriti? Memory. Virya and shraddha. These four things precede that state of integration. So these four things can help us on our yogic quest, on our yogic journey. What are they? What's shraddha? Faith or conviction. But what type of faith or conviction?
Steadfast.
Yeah.
Absolute.
Yeah. Vyasa, in the translation here, it says, it sustains the yogi like a mother. Now, how does a mother sustain its child?
Nurturing
it, feeding it, it's present, it's aware, yeah? How does our faith grow in yoga? How does our conviction grow?
Experience.
By experience. And how does that experience arise? It arises by practicing with faith and conviction. So, if we want to do a practice, how are we going to know if it works or not? We have to give it a wholehearted attempt. If we don't give it a wholehearted attempt, we'll never really know if we can do it or not, or if it's going to work for us or not. So we have to give it an honest, wholehearted attempt. But if we do, then we know for ourselves, oh, it didn't work for me. Oh yes, I know. When I take that time to shut things down and sit, then when I go, I do feel different. The world does look different. I do notice more skillfulness, more grace in the way that I can interact with other people and conduct my responsibilities in the world. And so what happens? Our faith grows, yeah? And that supports then virya. What is virya?
Courage.
No, but Paul was sat in virasana a few moments ago.
Courage, strength.
Courage, strength, yeah. So vira is a hero. You know Virabhadrasana, the yogic warrior. So virya is that quality that a hero has of heroic vigor. When the hero is in a tight spot, what does the hero do? Summons their forces, their awareness to bring forth their best effort, yeah? They don't shut... Oh, okay, never mind. they really summon their courage and their strength, and they, you know, pull out their best performance in a tight spot, yeah? So heroic vigor is what makes a hero. It's fine to be full of great positive qualities when everything's going easy, but it's the hero who can do it even when things are not going so according to plan. So virya is the quality of a hero, and it means having great courage. So courageousness. So we have conviction and courage, heroic valor, heroic vigor. So when we're practicing in the world, sometimes it's not so easy. And hence, we need this quality of virya. I've given this example before a few days ago, so some of you might be hearing it a second time, but if I'm a teacher, I have very little savings or anything like that. I've not really lived in England since 1999, but I'm pretty sure that if I was to walk down the high street of any town in my native country where I hold a passport and citizenship, I could find more than one person, even in the smallest town, who would guarantee that they could lend me enough money for me to buy a house that I would have very little hope of realistically paying back. Is this true? However, if I was to scour those streets looking for somebody who would teach me or guide me or encourage me to investigate my internal reality and my essential nature, I might scour many towns and find no master or no guide. Is this true? Mm-hmm. And of course we can find these people in the world. And once we start practicing with faith and with conviction, nature will support us wonderfully well. But still, the way the world is, the momentum is all rushing towards externals. Consumer society is all based on, let me buy this and I'll feel better. So it's designed to make us feel miserable and lacking, when really, we are wholeness and we are complete and we are all we need. So yogic practice is designed to make us realize that, so then we can just interact with the external world with discrimination and not be its slave. But contemporary society is designed, or is set up in many ways, one could say, this might sound rather extreme, to enslave us. So when we decide, I'm not going to accept that, we're going against the mainstream. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And if you're going against the mainstream, you need to be a hero. So when you start practicing yoga, you sign up to join the army of the warriors of light and love, who will resist, through their own steady, discerning effort, the malignant forces, the malevolent forces of consumer society, and will instead take a stand and act energetically in such a way to send out a positive influence, one that encourages ourselves and all those around us to recognize that there are always alternative ways to live, and the choices that the mainstream may offer us, there's way more choices than that. And what happens when we do have great vigor and energy and conviction and courage in our practice? If we practice with wholehearted devotion, how do we feel?
Full.
Full, good. So smriti, we get an impression of how it feels to be integrated through samadhi. So as we experience samadhi, that leaves an impression, which then bolsters our faith to keep practicing, and it strengthens our courage. So then when the storm comes and the world is saying, telling us to run away from practice and forget it, and when doubts come, as they will, it's part of the path, we don't know. I know that it's actually worth my pursuing that path that I've committed to, because I recognize that the practice is nourishing and it is helping me deal better with these mounting challenges, and this mounting challenge that has come is only a test and an opportunity for me to deepen my capacity for integration in samadhi, so let me embrace it. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so faith, when we have faith and conviction, it's easier to feel courageous in a tight spot. When we have overcome obstacles with conviction and courage, then it enters our memory, it reminds us, yes, we can overcome these difficulties. And if we can hold samadhi even in a tight spot, that gets even stronger, bolsters our faith even more, bolsters our courage even further, and so on. So these four all support each other. And this is a pattern that we'll notice as you continue to study Patanjali. Whenever he provides a group or a a group of concepts or principles or practices, they are always mutually supportive. And so that is a nice, and I think a fitting place to close today. So let us practice with great faith, conviction, be courageous, and open to the gifts of yoga and share them freely. So thank you very much, everyone, for sharing today.
I'd like to thank James and all of the kindred spirits, voices, and hearts here with us today, and to remind us to keep in mind the concepts we've discussed as we walk through the next few weeks. Let's notice our experiences in relation to them and see as well how our practice of yogasana, pranayama, and contemplation and or meditation might also bring more clarity to these subjects. We'll look forward to hearing about each other's observations and experiences in our next meeting.
Remember to check our website and its related links for more information on our future meetings. That's www.wayoftheyogi.com.
For now, walk in peace. But know that though we may make the journey in the company of each other, it is still an individual path we follow to the ultimate unification with the infinite within each of us. Loka sumosta sukhino bhavantu. May all beings experience the blessings of eternal happiness. Om Shanti. Namaste.